You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. On August 29th of this year, we featured Legal Services for Children and discussed the rights your children have at school as it relates to educational rights. Tonight, we resume the series, Your Kids' Rights at School. This time, we look at police investigations, search issues, interrogation issues that may arise in the schoolhouse setting. And you'll learn the significance of the phrase, bong hits for Jesus. My guests tonight are Rick Halpern, the Juvenile Court Managing Attorney for the Private Defender Program of San Mateo County, and James Wade, Assistant San Mateo County District Attorney, who recently completed his assignment, and this is some 9 years, as Deputy in Charge of the Juvenile Division in San Mateo County. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area that's outside of San Francisco, please call us toll-free. Our number here is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. With any questions you may have for our guests, we're going to be discussing those limited issues, but that doesn't mean you should limit your calls. If you have any questions at all about your children, their rights when they're involved in a criminal setting, whether it's in school or elsewhere, anything that has to do with delinquency law, please feel free to call our guests. But here's the gravamen of what we're here to discuss tonight. Your son or daughter comes home, tells you that the police were at the school, or the police wanted to talk to them. Our talk tonight is designed to tell you about the lay of the land. James, Rick, let me welcome you both to Your Legal Rights.
Hello.
Hello, Jeff. Thank you. James.
Hello, Jeff.
James, Rick, welcome both. I'd like to start here. Tell me, Rick, do your kids have constitutional rights?
Yes, they do, Jeff. Basically, children have the same constitutional rights as adults.
And what about at school?
Pretty much the same, too, Jeff. Children don't check their constitutional rights at the schoolroom door.
James, how about that?
I would agree somewhat with what Rick has to say. However, schools have special regulations which allows them to do things that law enforcement couldn't do on their own. And there's a reason for that, because, of course, when students are at school, they're the responsibility of the school, and they want to make sure that any individuals that are at school are protected. So because of that, the rights that they have, schools have to do things, are less rigid than what law enforcement has.
If I may respond to that just briefly, and I don't disagree with James. However, a lot of it depends on the issues that we're talking about. So children's rights, for example, First Amendment rights are basically the same. However, in the school setting, schools do have some right to control what and how speech occurs. In terms of the search and seizure law, again, school children have those rights under the Fourth Amendment and also Fifth Amendment rights.
Well, that is right. But, again, with schools, the school personnel themselves have their own set of rules that they have to abide by in order to make sure that all school children are safe while they're at school. And this includes the right to do things that law enforcement couldn't do on their own because of the standard they have. Their standard is more of a reasonableness standard instead of maybe probable cause like a police officer would have to have to conduct a search.
So one thing that you have to take into consideration also is there's two arenas involving children's rights. One is the arena of the school and school discipline, which I think you said you talked about a week or two ago. And the other is what would happen in the courtroom setting. In other words, if an offense occurs at school and that matter ends up into the courtroom, the rights of the child are different in the two arenas.
Ultimately, we're going to break this down a little bit. We're going to talk about different things that happen at school, different things that happen with police involvement. But as Rick just pointed out, when we're talking about education rights, things that result in suspensions, expulsions, things, there's a completely different standard that applies, particularly in a public school. Private schools are on a different page entirely, and they don't necessarily coincide with what the response should be to police activity, what the children's rights are. And tonight we're focused on that, the latter. We're talking about when the police are involved, when there's criminal activity charged, which they don't even call criminal for juveniles. But that's what we're focusing on tonight. The other was we did a show back in August, which is available to stream at KALW.org for those who wish to hear it. But tonight, what I really want to get into is, let's roll back the tape and take a step at the big picture. Rick, your son or daughter comes home and tells you that the police wanted to talk with them at school. What do you tell the parents to do? What's the first thing that they should be doing?
The first thing, it would depend on what the police wanted to talk to them about to begin with, and it might depend on whether they were the witness to some offense or whether or not they're being accused of some offense. So being a lawyer, I would be talking to my child to find out exactly what it is the police wanted to talk about, and personally, I would likely then seek some legal assistance before I went ahead and allowed my child to talk to the police.
However, in certain situations, the police do have the right to speak to individuals at school. One of the things is if they're a witness to a crime and not necessarily a suspect in a crime, an officer can talk with that individual without first contacting that minor's parents to get permission. There's another way in which officers can talk to a minor without having the parent's permission, and that's if the crime that's being committed is being committed by the parent themselves. Officers can investigate that situation without, you know, alerting the parents to the fact that the minor is being questioned.
So I think what James is doing is focusing on what the police officer's right is, and he's correct in that. But the minor also has a right, just like any citizen, to not talk to the police if they don't want to. And that is whether or not they're a witness or a suspect themselves, that they are not compelled to talk to the police. What happens a lot of time in a school setting is that they're called to a vice principal or a principal's office, and the vice principal or principal directs the student to talk to the police. And, of course, what our children are taught from the time they start kindergarten and maybe even before is to, you know, obey the rules in school and do what school officials tell them to do. So sometimes that can become problematic when a case gets into the legal arena.
Do the parents have a right to be notified? If I'm a police officer and I want to talk to your kid about something I suspect that he did, do you have a right to be called first?
And I would agree. That is something. I mean, I talk to lots of parents because my office represents most of the juveniles charged with criminal offenses in San Mateo County. And that's a question that a lot of parents have. The same question arises when my attorneys want to talk to their children in private. And parents are usually outraged about that, and I totally get it. I understand if your child is being accused of something, and you're the parent, you want to know what's going on. But because in that instance, because of the attorney-client relationship, we like to talk to the children separately.
When does the law require a police officer to notify the children of their Miranda rights? And before you answer, if you ponder that thought for just a moment, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. Tonight we're discussing your children, the school, the police, investigations, interrogations, search, all these issues in the schoolhouse setting, but also what might happen outside of school. My guests tonight are James Wade, Assistant District Attorney, recently completed his stint as of 9 years as Deputy in Charge of the Juvenile Division of the District Attorney's Office of San Mateo County, and Rick Halpern, the Managing Attorney for the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar, providing the defense of almost all the juveniles that come before the juvenile court in San Mateo County. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local calling area, our number is 866-798-8255. That's toll free, 866-798-8255. Where we left off, we were starting to talk about Miranda rights. Do children have Miranda rights?
Yes, just as an adult does, the minors and children have the same rights. It's very interesting with the question that you asked, because a lot of information that police officers obtain, they obtain through the interview process. However, the law has changed recently with regards to questioning of minors without having their attorney's presence. The law has changed now to where any minor under 16 years old, if they are being questioned by a law enforcement officer because they're suspected of committing a crime, they now can't question the minor unless they've contacted an attorney for the minor or obtained an attorney for the minor. The minor has had that opportunity to speak to the attorney, and the attorney then allows them to speak to the officer. That's really been a change in what the law is, because up until last year, that was not the law. The police did not have to contact an attorney for the minors under 16 years old prior to questioning them.
So if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that if a child is 15 or under...
16 or under.
Well, 16. It's 15 years, 11 months, 29 days, and 23 hours and 59 minutes. Basically, as long as they're under 16 years old, they get the benefit of making sure that they have legal representation before they can be questioned by law enforcement.
And for lay people listening, when we talk about Miranda rights, we're talking about instructing anybody. You have the right to remain silent. If you give up that right, anything you say can and will be used against you. You have the right to have an attorney present during questioning. And if you cannot afford one, one will be provided for you. And if I understand what you're saying correctly, is the minor can't waive that if they're before their 16th birthday. You have to have them have an opportunity to speak with an attorney before they can waive those rights. Is that?
That is correct.
The Miranda law, or how Miranda is applied, it applies to juveniles in exactly the same way it applies to adults. So the law that Mr. Wade is referring to is a law that adds an additional step where you're dealing with children 16 years of age or younger, that before the police can obtain a Miranda waiver, the minor has the right to be to talk to an attorney concerning those rights.
And in most counties around, what they're doing is they're having somebody available for the police to call if a minor gets arrested.
So, for example, my office has a hotline that every police agency in San Mateo County has that is covered by an attorney 24/7, 365 days a year.
And I would like everybody to enjoy a Thanksgiving. Have a wonderful time with your families. Enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner. I will be the attorney on call in San Mateo County on Thanksgiving. But I digress.
Jeff is right about that. It's because I suggested it's a good way to get away from the family on Thanksgiving.
And hopefully none of mine are listening right now.
Sorry, Jeff.
Actually, you said that after I'd already signed up, giving me second thoughts, but we're here. That all said, when do police have to give Miranda rights? Do either one of you want to take a crack at that?
Well, they have to give Miranda rights to anybody that they're questioning with regards to them being a suspect in a criminal investigation. Once they've made the determination that they are a suspect and they're about to arrest an individual for a crime, they must advise them of Miranda rights.
With one correction, it needs to be custodial. So and what is considered custodial becomes a question of fact a lot of times in court. So if they're handcuffed and thrown in the back of a police car or locked in a cell, that's clearly custodial. But there other issues can arrive, and particularly in the context going back, bringing us back to schools, we have a number of cases where a minor might be called to the vice principal's office and where a police officer would be sitting by the door saying, "You're free to leave," and an issue would arise as to whether or not that minor or a reasonable minor would feel that they're free to leave under those circumstances. So what is considered custodial is a matter for the judge to ultimately decide.
In adult cases, there's a Supreme Court case that the three of us are all familiar with, in which a gentleman named Mendenhall was not supposedly under arrest. The police didn't believe he was under arrest. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that the real test is whether a reasonable person would have felt free to leave. And, Rick, you brought up an interesting point. What happens when, according to the police, this young man or young woman is free to leave, but they're in the principal's office, and the principal's office is saying, "No, sit right there"? Are they at that point entitled to be given their Miranda rights? What happens if they're under 16?
Well, in that particular case, Jeff, I'm going to be saying yes, and James is going to be saying no.
That is correct.
And what's going to happen, assuming that the minor then makes a statement and he's arrested and the case goes to the district attorney and they file the case, then the lawyer, assuming the case proceeded to trial, the lawyers would make a motion before the defense attorneys would make a motion before the court to exclude the statement. James's office would be arguing that it's perfectly legal, and a judge would decide.
That is correct. The biggest thing we'd have to look at is we look at all the objective symptoms and objective signs around the detention itself to determine whether or not a reasonable person would have believed they were under arrest at the time that the law enforcement was trying to either ask them questions.
And this is an example of where the standard might be different for an adult and a juvenile. In other words, that, again, depending on the age and the sophistication of the juvenile, those things would be taken into consideration in terms of looking what a reasonable juvenile might consider under the circumstances.
So we're talking about an interrogation. The young person is taken to the principal's office. They may or may not be entitled to have their rights read to them. But whether they have the right to an attorney doesn't necessarily coincide with the officer's duty to inform them. What happens when a young person is in the principal's office? The police are there to either listen in or to participate, and the young person asks for their parent or asks for an attorney to be present.
Well, that would depend upon what the role of the law enforcement officer is. The law enforcement officer is standing, listening, not actually participating in the interview that is being done by the school, then there may not be any reason or to advise them of their rights at that point, because it may be just the school investigation going on versus a police investigation. It's really the turning point is when something turns from something that is being investigated by the school versus something that's being investigated by law enforcement.
So, for example, and I think James would probably agree with this, if the police officer went to the vice principal and said, "Look, I don't have enough cause to get to even interview this child or to have him talk to me, or he said he wanted an attorney, so I'd like you to do it. There you have direct police involvement, and in that case, you would be dealing with a different situation than if it's simply the school that's doing it.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. If they're acting as a quasi-police agency by asking these questions for the benefit of the officer, that would be a different thing than if the police or the school was doing their investigation on their own.
I must say I'm taken aback. I've known each of you for 20 years plus, and I don't think I've ever heard the two of you agree on so much as you have tonight. It does give me pause. We talked a little bit about the school administrators and what their role might be, whether they're a partner for law enforcement or they're doing something to do with the school. And I guess the place to start is let's start with the situation where something happens at the school. Does the young person have the same Fourth Amendment rights as would an adult at their place of work? You're both smiling.
I think this is where we would have a disagreement, because
I'm hoping for it.
Again, it would really depend upon what the criminal activity was and whether there was a situation where the police were doing something for the safety of other individuals at the school. There are emergency situations where officers have to act differently because of the fact that they're balancing competing interests, the interest of all the students at the school versus the suspect minor who may be committing a crime or may be doing something. An example is an individual that makes a threat over social media, and it gets reported to the school and thereafter gets reported to police. Now, the police have to do something about that because they don't know whether this threat is credible or not. They can do more because of that than in other situations because of the exigency of it and the public safety for students or other students at the school.
So I disagree in the sense that if it's strictly the police that are conducting a search, even though it's on the school, that the standard that they're going to be stuck with is the same standard that they would be stuck with in terms of if they were doing it off the school with an adult. Exigent circumstances are an exception to searches basically anywhere, assuming that when the matter gets to court, those circumstances can be proven. So I would think that the police, the two different standards basically is reasonable circumstances or cause, which is what school officials are bound by, and probable cause, which is a higher standard. And I would argue that the police would still be bound to the probable cause standard unless an exception would apply, which might be considered public safety.
And that would be the argument that we would have. We would be looking at the public safety, the safety of the mass school children versus the individual school person. And we would make the argument that it's justified based upon that exigency. And that's where I think the fight would be in court between the defense attorney and my office.
And it would depend on the facts as to whether there would be a fight with that or not.
What about my kid goes to school and he wants to say something over the school's loudspeaker that's probably disruptive, probably not to the level of a loud and unreasonable noise, but it might interfere with the school, and it's clearly violative of the school's rules and their ability to function, but it has nothing to do with safety, nothing to do with criminal law. When can the school go in and search his locker? When can the police go in and search his locker?
Well, part of that, Jeff, would depend on the locker policy itself at the school. So if the locker, if it's determined the locker is the property of the school, then they probably have a right to go into it. If, however, it's determined that the locker is basically the in possession and the property of the student, then they would need the reasonable cause in order to search it.
Right, and they would have to have a determination that something illegal was occurring before they could actually enter the locker itself. In your scenario, if the minor is just being loud and obnoxious, so to speak, that wouldn't give cause for a school personnel to go to their locker and conduct a search of their locker.
And again, just a reminder for our listeners, we're talking about a public school setting because your constitutional rights are a contract between you and your government. So if your son or daughter is enrolled at a private school, a parochial high school, something that's not a public school, there may be a different set of rules that apply because your constitutional rights between you and your government might not cross that threshold. So we've been talking about what if something's going on at school, what if something's about to go on or might be going on at school, what the school officials can and can't do. What if something happens somewhere else? Now, that's going to open up a big, broad discussion, but I want to focus on some of these same issues. If you have a young person who is alleged to be involved in activity that on its face doesn't involve the school, but the school officials have a reason to think maybe it does happen there. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We're discussing your children, the school, the police, investigation, search, interrogation issues, even free speech issues in the schoolhouse setting. And before the evening's out, you will learn the significance of the phrase, bong hits for Jesus. My guests tonight are Rick Halpern, the managing attorney of the Juvenile Court Program for the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar. And again, Rick oversees the attorneys representing almost every young person brought before the courts in San Mateo County. And James Wade, assistant San Mateo County District Attorney, who just completed his 9-year assignment as deputy in charge of the juvenile division, and he oversaw the attorneys that prosecuted every young person that came before the courts in San Mateo County. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number us in the studio is 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. If you're not located in San Francisco and you'd like to call us toll-free, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And before we go away, we're going to be discussing what happens when something happens outside of school, whether it's aimed at students, whether there's a fear that it's going to implicate the school, but it doesn't. When do some of these rights give way? When can the school officials get involved? Just in case. When can the police get involved? Just in case. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So, getting back to when something happens elsewhere, you have a young person who maybe, because of activity on the internet or because of rumors around the school, may be involved in things that pique the interest of the school officials. What can they do that differs? When can they look in their lockers? When can they talk to them? Who would like to field that one?
It would depend upon what the crime is and is there any real connection between the criminal activity and the school itself. The internet has become such a really interesting situation because it can be used for good, but it also can be used for illegal activity. And things that are said on the internet can impact a school tremendously. We've seen it situations where individuals have made threats that they're going to blow up a school or they're going to shoot up a school. And these types of situations trigger school officials to be on a heightened alert. And their standard, the school official standard, is a lot less than what police officers' standard are, because if they reasonably believe that criminal activity is occurring or could be occurring on school grounds, they do have the right to conduct an investigation and even conduct searches of individuals to determine if, in fact, they do have anything that would be deemed illegal. So it's a tough situation when you're taking things that occur outside of school, but they impact the school itself, because the school has to always think about their students and the safety of their students.
It goes back, though, Jeff, to the same thing we've been talking about on the school grounds. So if the police, for example, are investigating a robbery that takes place off the school, and they call the vice principal and say, hey, we're investigating Johnny for a robbery, would you mind looking in his locker and see if he's got a ski mask in there? You're going to go back to that's considered police action and going to be dealing with the higher standard. So it's really not much different in the sense it's only different in the sense that it makes it a little more remote as far as the school is concerned in terms of them having reasonable cause as opposed to something that's actually taking place now on the school grounds. But it's really the same rules that are going to apply.
We've talked a lot about search, about questioning young people at school. Let's change direction. Let's put the Fourth Amendment aside. We'll put the Fifth Amendment aside.
James would probably like to do that.
It would make my job a little easier.
For the purpose of discussion, anyway. Let's talk about the First Amendment. When does free speech give way at school?
Well, free speech doesn't give way at school because you could still say certain things. It's only when that speech will affect individuals at the school and causes individuals to be leery of whether criminal activity is going to occur. I.e., if somebody's on school grounds and says, I have a knife and I'm going to kill Ms. So-and-so teacher. Well, some people would say, oh, that's free speech. They're just talking about what is on their mind. Others would look at that as a criminal threat that needs to be investigated, and so law enforcement might become involved. It really depends on what the speech is.
Rick, do you agree with that?
Because there's a criminal statute that James is referring to that this would be prosecuted under. And there's both constitutional and statutory standards under that statute for what is considered a speech that can be prosecuted and what is considered speech that can't. Just kind of looking at this from a different perspective, which is not so much from what necessarily would be a criminal aspect, but schools have the responsibility to keep kids from being bullied. And bullying is a form of speech. It can be a form of free speech, but the school districts itself can get into trouble when they've received a complaint about a child bullying another child and not taking action for it. So that's another area where I think the school has a right to abridge speech to some extent.
What if I do something or say something really off the wall and it interferes with the school function? I threatened earlier tonight I was going to let everybody know, or I'm going to let you guys let everybody know. What is the significance of the phrase, bong hits for Jesus?
I can't wait, Jeff.
Yes, we're waiting for that.
I kind of thought one of you would field that. That was actually a banner. I did not make that up. That's not me speaking. It was a banner hung outside of a school setting from a young person, because the Olympic torch relay was passing by, and he was in proximity to the school. Are either one of you familiar with that case? It made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's been about 10 years. And what it stands for?
I'm not.
I am not either.
Both of you are smiling and laughing and taking a step back and leaving this one in my lap. Thank you both very much. This was a case that stood for the issue that free speech rights in school may be limited to the point, to the extent that they interfere with school functioning. This person was suspended. The case, he challenged a suspension. The district court agreed and said, too bad, you can't disrupt school like that. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit reversed it and said, no, this is First Amendment free speech. Sorry, school, you're out of luck. The school district said not so fast and took it to the United States Supreme Court in a case called Frederick v. Morse. It's been 10 years since that decision was landed, and the Supreme Court said, no, the district court had it right, and you don't have absolute constitutional rights to free speech in school when it's clearly aimed at the school. The fact that the banner was hung across the street is of no moment. The issue is that banner was hung to disrupt school activities. The young man was at those school activities. It was granted during this Olympic torch relay because he knew there'd be a lot of attention, but it was really aimed at the school, and based on that, the suspension was warranted. And the school was vindicated some years after the young man would have already graduated, because it takes that long for it to get through the system. And you will never again hear me say on the air the phrase, bong hits for Jesus. I hope you're both happy.
We're grateful for that.
Thank you very much.
So we've talked a bit about school searches. We've talked about school investigation for things that happen on campus. We've talked about school investigation when things happen off campus. We've talked about police investigation on campus when it affects something happening on campus, and the police investigation in the school is more than happy to help, even though it has nothing to do with the school. Let's leave the school behind. Let's talk about a young person's rights when they're arrested or when they're dealing with the police. What happens when a young person's arrested and he says or she says, I want my mom? Either one of you care to field that one?
Well, if we're dealing with a kind officer, he might call mom, but it's unlikely. For a short time in California, it was the law that asking for a parent was considered the same as asking for an attorney, but that has long since been overturned by the courts. So the minor has no right to talk to his parents before the police interrogate him.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, that's the state of the law as it is right now. The only absolute right that the minor has with regards to that is if they ask for an attorney. If they ask for an attorney, the officer must have an attorney present before any questioning goes on.
And that would be the same as an adult. If I wanted an attorney, they can't really question me until they get my lawyer there, or at least a lawyer there.
That's correct.
What if the young person says, I don't want to talk to you?
Well, then, of course, it's up to the police officer to make a determination as to whether that's an invocation of their rights or it's just a situation where they don't want to say anything at this point in time. But the officer can still ask questions until the minor says they want an attorney or they just won't say anything, and then the officer either arrests them or contacts their parents or just does something different.
So a disagreement, and that is that it's not really the officer's decision as to whether or not when the minor says, I don't want to talk to you, that he's basically invoking his right to remain silent. That's ultimately a decision that's going to be made by the court. So the officer may decide in his mind that that's not a invocation of the right to remain silent, get a statement from the child. The child's attorney may then make a motion in court, and the judge is going to decide whether or not that, in fact, was an invocation.
Right, but that's where an argument will be definitely waged between the prosecution and the defense, because we have to look at the situation itself and what was actually said. A statement that I just don't want to talk could mean I don't want to talk to you at this point right now, but I'll talk to you later. These are things that will have to definitely be determined by the judge at court, because I'm sure this would be a bone of contention between both the prosecution and defense.
One thing we can all agree, we have a caller on the line, Jason from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you very much. I just want to say quick, it's a very fascinating topic, and I'm interested to know, are you discussing high school and below, or are you including college? And also, what are the differences range from, if there are any, between the two?
When we talk about minors, we're talking about individuals that are under 18 years old. Once they get over 18 years old, they're going to be handled as an adult. So the standards will definitely be a little different in handling people in college, if they're, of course, over 18 years old, versus individuals that are being under 18 years old. And that's what we were discussing.
Right. I've always viewed these issues as being high school and below, not college. The First Amendment issues concerning things that maybe can be said are probably fairly similar, but these issues that we're talking about are basically for children that are in high school, middle school, and elementary school.
But, Jason, you bring up kind of a fuzzy line, because you do have occasionally young people that are under 18 but that have gone on to college, and you have occasionally people that may not have advanced with the people in their age group, and they may still be in high school. And the high schools are geared with the understanding of what they need to do with young people, and colleges may be less so. So sometimes by putting one person in the other population or vice versa, you may lead to some unusual results.
Thank you.
It's actually a good question, Jason. I've never really thought about it, and I'm really myself not sure if the same standard they're talking about in terms of searching, for example, in high school would be the same in college. I don't know the answer to that.
Jason, I hope we answered you, and thank you for joining us. That was some very interesting questions, and I don't know that anybody really knows the answer other than sorting through it on a case-by-case.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. And William from Belvedere, welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you very much. The host said something which I'm not sure it's true. The host said if a policeman wants to ask me questions, he has to wait till my attorney is there. I don't think that's true. I think a policeman can talk to anybody they want to. You don't have to answer them, but I don't think they have, if you ask for an attorney. But when is it that the Miranda rights come in? In other words, it's my understanding that when someone is arrested, at least at that point, the policeman tells you could have an attorney. And would it be that they don't tell the child that they could have an attorney? The information, maybe it has to do with before arrest and after arrest, but I'd like to know when the Miranda rights come in and why they don't come in for children if they don't come in for children.
William, before I turn it over to my guests, because each of them are ready to jump in and answer this, I want to clarify. I didn't say that the police aren't free to talk to a young person without their attorney being present, but both I and my guests have agreed that there are some instances where the right to a young person to have an attorney may be broader than it is for an adult, in the sense that they may not have the ability to waive that right. And James, you were the first to right. look like you were ready, so I'm going to let you jump in and bail me out here.
That's it. Well, first of all, Miranda always deals with a custodial interrogation. It's when police officers are going to do a custodial interrogation, which is basically when somebody has all the earmarks of being under arrest.
Right.
That's when the rights kick in. However, for juveniles, especially individuals that are under 16 years old, police officers who are going to arrest an individual, a minor, can't even ask them questions without having an attorney present. Mm-hmm. The new law that came out said anyone under 16 years old, before any questioning is done by law enforcement, has to contact an attorney for that minor and get that attorney's permission to allow the questioning by a police officer. So that's the difference, I think, that you're referring to.
Thank you. Thank you.
And William, if you recognize this as contrary to what you believed before listening tonight, this is new law. This is only in effect since the first of the year. It's in effect under a statute of the state of California. It may not be the same if you cross the line into Oregon or Nevada, but that is the current state of the law in California. Rick, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
I think the important thing to note is that once a custodial interrogation, which means, as James explained, your freedom to leave basically is being impaired, and the police want to question you, they have to advise you of your Miranda rights. And once they do that, they then ask you for a waiver of those rights, and if you waive them, then the police go ahead and talk to you. If you tell them you don't want to talk to them, then they cease questioning. As was mentioned, with children 16 years of age, or under the age of 16, I should say, in California, the police, before they can obtain that waiver, have to allow the minor to have a consultation with an attorney. So that's how the new law kicks in. So as Jeff explained, and I think as James explained, the rights for minors are actually broader, not narrower, than they are for adults.
The questions we've been getting so far have been fascinating and very well stated. I would encourage more of them. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden, and we are discussing your children, the school, the police, investigations, search, interrogation issues, when you're free to speak in a schoolhouse setting and elsewhere. My guests tonight are James Wade, Assistant San Mateo County District Attorney, and Rick Halpern, Juvenile Court Managing Attorney. Both of these men were on respective sides of the aisle or supervising the attorneys who were, with almost all cases going through the juvenile court in San Mateo County for the last 7 years. If you have questions for my guests, and we have a few minutes left if you have questions for my guests, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, please feel free to call toll-free. Our number is 866-798-8255. Again, do it on our nickel. The number is 866-798-8255. We did have a caller that called in, and rather than asking to go on the air, left me with the following. Said, I was speaking the other day at the Dean of Discipline at a local San Francisco high school. And the caller opines that back in the old days, there were none of those deans at his high school. Discipline incidents have gone way up, he says, which necessitates having a full-time dean in charge of discipline. He blames it on the internet. Many of these discipline problems have to do with cyberbullying, sexting, calling kids together for a fight, things of that nature. And asked about this. Wanted me to ask each of my guests what they think of a rule that requires students to leave their mobile devices at home and not allow them on campus. Do you think that poses constitutional issues, or do you think that that's something that's appropriate in the school setting?
I don't think it would cause a constitutional crisis. I think it would cause a riot at the school, however.
I would agree with Rick. I think that a school could have a policy that anyone who has a cell phone has to turn it off while they're at school, et cetera, because of the issues that cell phones cause and the disruption that it can cause at the school itself. So I don't think it would rise to a constitutional issue, but it would be more of a school policy.
I mean, I think schools have rules that phones have to be off, for example, and so I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that you not have the phones at all at school. But again, looking sadly at what's happening in schools across the country with shootings and whatnot, there is a bit of a public safety issue with children actually having phones at school. So it's not a the phones are not only being misused by students, it's a way for parents to know and be in communication with their children and know where their children are. So it's really a two-way street.
Anna Maria from San Francisco, welcome. Your legal rights.
Hi. As you can imagine, it's alarming for a minor to be faced with being arrested or held by or interrogated without their parents or anyone that they are comfortable with. So do you know, is there a systematic program to educate minors on the procedures and the rules and so that they know that this is out there for them?
I don't know if there's a systematic program. I know that lawyers from time to time do speak at high schools, and the new law for minors 16, under the age of 16 in California is very valuable in reaching minors that are actually in this situation while they've been arrested.
So that's too late, though. It's nice for them to know in advance so they don't get arrested. So that would be something we should think about, getting some lawyers to put together. So there's a systematic program to educate youth.
I would absolutely agree.
And Anna-Marie, just to make sure that I understand what you're saying, are you talking about a program that teaches young people some civics and they understand what their rights are? And
I don't want to use the general term civics. I want to use the term knowing your legal rights and your responsibilities. A systematic education of our youth so they know their legal rights and their responsibilities so that they don't have the shock of being a part of the system. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. James, are you agreeing? You're shaking your head up and down.
Well, so I'm going to give you that task to start organizing that.
I understand what you're saying, and a lot of schools do have programs.
I've never seen it.
Well, there are programs that talk about, and it may be part of the civics classes that go on.
Do we have civics?
Yes, there's a lot of schools that have civics. But the other thing is, a lot of schools have community resource officers or school resource officers that are on their campuses, and they explain to the minors why they're there.
To tell you that I know from firsthand that some youth have been shocked and alarmed by the experience of coming into contact in a with law enforcement and being the what shall I call them, the focus of law enforcement. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. Maybe some wonderful person is listening and they will fund something locally, statewide, and nationally, so our youth know, you know, what's going on.
Anna Maria, there's two things that come to mind. The first is whether something, a program like that, should be done at the local level, within the local communities, and community by community doing it, as opposed to something larger and global. But to the extent that the government was involved, they may have a conflict of interest. Because teaching people their rights also makes it harder for law enforcement. So it might be something that's best done privately at the local level.
That's why I'm hoping somebody's listening out there who has the backing, the funding, and they will start this. If I win the lottery, I'll start it.
That sounds good. If you win the lottery, please stay in touch, and I can put
you... I love your legal rights.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye.
And thank you for joining us tonight.
Sure. Bye-bye.
The last question I wanted to ask you, we're getting close to the end of the hour. I do want to reserve a little bit of time for each of you to sum up with any last-minute thoughts, but there is one question that we didn't get to, and that has to do with searches. I remember growing up that my parents and some of the other parents, friends that I grew up with, had very different views on some of these subjects. Suppose the police came to my house and I'm 16, 15, 14. They suspected that I might be up to no good. What rights do I have to say, no, you can't go into my house or you can't go into my room? And what if my parents disagree?
Do you each have a thought about that?
Well, that's actually two questions in one, because it's what the parents can do and what they can agree to their home versus if the parents aren't there and the child is by themselves and what the officer can do. Officers cannot go into a residence without either a warrant or some type of exigency or permission. That permission can be given, of course, by a parent because they are technically the owner of the house, and they would have apparent authority to allow an officer to come in and conduct a search if they made the request and there was consent. So the answer to if a minor says, you can't come into my house, my parents aren't here, an officer can't go into the house unless, like I said, there is some exception, some exigency, some emergency that's going on. So that's generally how that would be handled.
If the parent is the one allowing the police officer into the house, the parents don't have the right to consent to the search of the minor's affairs. So that would be a separate issue, that the parents might be in the house. The parents then say, yes, go into my son's bedroom. The bedroom is solely the son's, and they say you can search anywhere in here, and they search in drawers and whatnot. That search would likely be illegal.
Well, and that's where the argument would be, because I would say that's not illegal because of the fact that the parents have authority to allow searches in their residence.
And that would include, in your mind, the room, my room, within my parents' house?
Yes.
And I strongly disagree. I've won a number of motions to suppress on that issue.
And I think that's going to be
the... And I've gone the other way, and I've won motions where that has come up, and the court has agreed with me.
With that, that's going to be the last word on the subject. I'd like to thank you both, and before we leave, I would like to give you each about a minute, but we've got about 2 minutes left total. Take about half that to sum up, if you would.
Well, the thing about juvenile court, and you have to remember, is we're all about rehabilitation. That's what the dictates of the juvenile court is. But in rehabilitation, there also is a designation for punishment also. So in our system, we try to look at everything that the minor is involved in. We try to look at what the minor needs to make themselves whole and to rehabilitate themselves. So that's the system that the juvenile law was made for, and that's what we try to do in San Mateo County.
Rick?
And the I think that all of the what we call the partners in the juvenile system agree that we're after what we believe is in the best interest of the minors. And in other words, when we talk about the best interest, we're talking about what we feel would be the best way to keep this child out of the criminal justice system if we can. And this includes probation, the district attorney's office, my office. Where we differ is in how we reach that end. So, where you know, it's my lawyer's feelings and my feelings, and this is backed up today by research, is, you know, incarceration for juveniles, by the way, is not good. So it looks like we're out of time, Jeff, and so I'll simply say to you, James, see you in court.
See you in court.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. My guest tonight have been Rick Halpern, the juvenile court managing attorney for the San Mateo County Private Defender Program, and James Wade, Assistant District Attorney in San Mateo County. Thank you both for joining us. Next week on Your Legal Rights, I'll be speaking with longtime participant and certified specialist Leon Bayer about bankruptcy and debtors' rights. Our thanks to you for listening, and our thanks to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, The Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.